So Father's Day. This picture is of me with my dad when I was about 2 months old. And my dad had gray hair for my entire memory. And there wasn't a time when I didn't have an old dad. I was one of seven kids, so even a meal at my house was like war maneuvers. But Mom and Dad were great at leading the charge, and I was the kid that sort of saw my role as the invisible kid. But I enjoyed the party, and I had moments when I got to step out on stage. Okay, let me embarrass myself by telling you that when I was in junior high, okay, up until this day, I sort of do magic tricks. And my family would sit around and watch me do the same tricks over and over and over again. But Mom and Dad led the way, and they cheered, and it was awesome. They had no idea how I did all that. They were amazed, and I was amazing. It was a lovely moment. A parent's job is so vital and so critical, and it's sort of a burden on my heart that there are so many bad dads in this world, because it reflects badly on the Father. On Father God, the one who really extends a father's mercy and protection and delight and all the beautiful good things that a father should bring, he modeled that and he offers that. But that sort of explains why dads come under so much spiritual attacks, and parents, the enemy comes after them frequently and hard, and that's sort of understandable. Parenting is so critical because they create a culture. In any household, the parents set a pace and determine for the entire family, this is how we solve problems. This is how we deal with money issues. This is the routine that goes with mealtime, the routine that goes with bedtime, the routine that happens with holidays. This is how we do holidays. We do Christmas this way, and we do Easter that way, and it's all up to the parent to set the pace and the tone. This is how your parents feel about chores, and so this is how you're going to behave as you're raised in our home. This is how we deal with money, how we spend money, and this is how we spend our time, and this is how we spend our creativity, and this is how we spend our playtime. They're the ones that establish the culture that says, and this is how we fit into our whole family system, how we fit into our community, how we fit into the school system, how we fit into our church. This is how we belong and where we belong. They set the pace. They create culture. And so parents, by their example, and parents, by their lack of example, they set the pace. It grieves me that not all dads are good. But in the study that we're beginning tonight, Now What? We're going to be challenged from the book of Matthew, from the words of Jesus in the first five chapters, to pay attention to what good parenting ought to be, to get an idea of what it's like when the parent knows what we're capable of and what is in us, because that's the culture he's created. So, the book of Matthew is written by a guy named Matthew, and he writes it to a Jewish audience. And so he starts speaking some very Jewish things right away. We're going to come back to that in just a moment. But Jesus starts out in chapter 5 as a rabbi. as a teacher, as one who has the responsibility, I'm saying it's parental responsibility, but he observes the needs around him and he responds by teaching. Chapter 5, the first two verses read like this. One day, as he saw the crowds and they were gathering, Jesus went up on top of a high mountain and he sat down, and his disciples gathered around him and he began to teach. Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is what Bible people call the Sermon on the Mount. And that's as far as we're going to study into Matthew with this study. But we're going to follow Jesus's wise lead. We're going to assume that he knows something about how the system ought to work. Not that everybody does it right. Not that all parents are good. Not that all leaders are good. But there's this system that's sort of inherent. And so I'm going to ask you first off to pay attention to your heart. Your heart is a terrific barometer, and there are going to be times that I'm going to read something from a text, we're going to discuss something together, and you're going to go, that resonates. That sounds true because it hits a chord inside me. That feels right. There's going to be a lot of those moments, and so before we even begin, I want to challenge you to pay attention to those moments. Your heart is good, and it's going to tell you some things that are valuable and good and important. So, Matthew tells this story. He's a Jewish guy. He was raised in a Jewish family, and he's bringing this Jewish community along with him. He begins in a very Jewish way. Sometime on your own time, read Matthew chapter 1, because it's remarkable. What is remarkable is, like every Jewish young man, they knew their genealogy. Every Jewish child had memorized who they came from. Father's Day was not just one or two generations. Matthew starts out by saying, here's the Jesus story. And he goes all the way back to King David. And that would be important to the Jewish listeners. Oh, he's from the tribe of David. He takes him all the way back to the tribe of Judah. Oh, the tribe of Judah. That's a big deal. He takes them all the way back to Abraham. He takes them all the way back to Adam. He traces Jesus' lineage from Joseph, his father, all the way back to his ultimate father, Adam. That's a very Jewish thing to do. We get bogged down. How do you pronounce all these weird names? But that's because we're not Jewish. If we knew Jewish, we would know how to pronounce it right, because we pronounced it so many times, it's in us. But right away, Matthew is changing the rules. Because, did you notice what I said just a minute ago? It sounded rather sexist of me when I said all Jewish young men. That's how the Jews thought. The women didn't count. The girls, they weren't obligated. Oh, they were bright and intelligent. And I assume that they had their genealogies memorized just like their older and younger brothers. But as Matthew starts retelling the Jesus story, he includes in the Jewish genealogies one guy who's, well, a Gentile. Oh, that was a no-no. Right away, the eyebrows did this. They mentioned a Gentile, but that wasn't where things got really scary. Matthew mentions women. Women in the genealogies. We Jews don't do that. It gets even worse. Not just a Jew, not just women, but one of these women was immoral. Wait, it gets worse. One of these women was a prostitute. Okay? All of a sudden, Matthew starts telling this story about Jesus, but he's not doing it right. He's not doing it very Jewish. He's changed the rules. And so he's got his listeners reading very carefully as they unpack this. As we go through the Sermon on the Mount, watch the Jewish eyebrows. Notice the times when they might have gone, oh, did you hear that? He's changed the rules again. Matthew's message about Jesus is, we're changing the system. What you've been used to is no longer going to be the same. Does that help a little bit with this pandemic that we're in the middle of? Do you sort of get the feeling that things are not going to be the same after this? Do you sort of think that this back to normal thing that we keep waiting for, it may not actually happen? I'm just telling you, I'm not going to do a series on the pandemic, but I'm going to say that Jesus has been saying, oh, you're discomforted now? You're not feeling really secure in this? It's okay. We're going to work with this, and you're going to find God in the middle of this. I'm just telling you, as we jump into now what, it's going to be one of those grand moments when the light is going to come up, when the sun is going to rise, and we're going to go, oh, I see something I did not see before. Some of those people that listened to Jesus, they were saying, now what? They were anticipating Jesus' words. They saw his authority. They knew of his teaching. They knew that he was credible, and they believed he was who he said he was. And so they were leaning forward and saying, now what, Jesus? You have the answers. Tell us what. They were devotees. But not all of them were. Some of them were saying, now what? Now what are you going to say that changes the rules? Now what are you going to ruin? Now what are you going to do to my eyebrows? Now what? Some of these people were skeptics. There's two groups that are sitting at Jesus' feet as he speaks on that mountain, and they were either devotees or skeptics. I need you to pause right now. Maybe if it's a recorded session, you really ought to literally pause, because I need you to choose which one you are. Which camp are you sitting in? As you sit at the feet of Jesus this evening, do you see yourself more as a devotee, as a follower, as a discipler, as a believer? Or do you see yourself leaning back just a little bit, being a bit skeptic? I'm listening, but I'm not sure. I know he was a good guy. I know he was a rabbi, but is he the answer for all of the answers? I need you to choose. Have you got the word in your head? We're going to come back to it later, and it's critically important. So don't blow me off like I'm just a face on the screen. I need you to choose. I call you to choose. Devotee or skeptic? Done? Are you good? Hold on to your answer, because your answer is about to be challenged. So the Matthew story is retelling an old story, a familiar story, but he's drawing different conclusions. It's not that Matthew was changing the story in any way. He was just saying, I'm going to come at it from this perspective, and I'm going to let everybody else see the Jesus that I've observed, who was a rule changer. Some of the Jewish people that were listening to Jesus, they were questioning his authority and worried about his approach, because they were so weary of the Roman quarantine. I mean, the Roman occupation. There was this thing that was pressed in on them. There was this dynamic that was so undoing. It was as if there was a disease that was taking over their country, and then somebody added to that riots. You know, it was just a mess, and they just didn't want him adding to the chaos. They were saying, no, now what? Now what are you doing to stir up trouble? They were just trying to be peaceful with the Romans and trying to negotiate life as best they could, and they didn't need one more rabble-rouser. Others were committed. And they were saying, I've been getting this feeling that this new definition of normal, we're going to have to unpack this. We're going to have to unravel this. This might be more complex than I'm perceiving things. And I need you to notice one specific word that Matthew repeats over and over and over, and that is the kingdom. The Jewish people have been waiting for a Messiah. The Jewish people have been anticipating the kingdom of God. They expected God any day now to break into history, and they were anxiously waiting for a Messiah to take down the Romans. For some of these listeners, it was a quick decision. He's not the one. He is not the one. He is not equipped to take over the Romans or anybody else. Others were going, this could be the kingdom breaking in right now. And Matthew is feeding those people. He uses the word kingdom over and over and over and over. The Jewish religion that was tidy and logical and black and white, it was clear. They had laws, and they had laws about their laws, and laws to bind in the laws that were about their laws. They had the laws. They had it figured out. They were people that knew. And all of that tidiness, Jesus isn't just going to start picking away at. All of that tidiness is going to be undone. It's not that God's law is going to be destroyed. As a matter of fact, through the presence of Jesus, Matthew is going to convince us, God's law is going to be fulfilled. It's going to be met. This was huge, and this is historic. And Matthew is going, you got to hear this. You got to see this. You got to catch this. You got to hear what I'm saying. And I think he would say what I'm about to say, that even though the Jesus presence is revolutionary and beautiful, it is not without cost. It is not easy. All the decorum and all of the safety and all of the civility and all the predictability that we once experienced in our life could very well be going out the window. I'm not talking about the coronavirus. I'm talking about what happens when Jesus moves in. And so while it's kind of tidy that we talk about this during COVID-19, during these crazy days, by the way, on commercials, are you as weary as I am of the phrase unprecedented days or whatever it is? People keep reminding us, every advertiser says, boy, things are not the same as they used to be. The personal implications are going to be obvious because we are drawn to tidiness. Tidy and black and white has a gravity all of its own, and we are drawn to it like a moth to a flame. It's our hunger and it's our passion, and we really need to know what the rules are and can we wear masks or can we not, because they told us this and now they're telling us that, and we don't know, and we just need to know. I'm going to ask you for a little bit longer to not know. I'm going to ask you for just a little bit longer to face the reality that it's okay if we don't know all the details, as long as we know somebody who does. And his name isn't Fauci. Matthew uses words that to the Jewish mind were descriptive and had power. Even Jesus' name means the Lord saves. And so right away, people are leaning forward. As soon as Matthew uses that word in the first 8 verses, that's significant. In chapter 1, verse 20, he refers to him as the son of David. That's a big deal in the Jewish mind because that means that's a signal word. That means he's Messiah. He uses the word in verse 28 of chapter 1, Emmanuel, which means God with us. And they all knew about the prophecies that Isaiah especially talked about when they said Messiah is going to be Emmanuel. He's going to be God with us. Matthew refers to him as the king in chapter 2, verse 2, as a ruler in verse 6 of chapter 2, as shepherd in verse 6 of chapter 2. Time and time again, Matthew is using words and descriptive words that have these Jewish people leaning forward and wondering, what's Matthew going to tell us next? And that gets us ready to jump all the way to chapter 5. I would encourage you to read the first four chapters, but especially in the next few weeks, I want to challenge you to read thoroughly chapters 5, 6, and 7. Chapter 5 begins like this. He sat down and he began to teach them. God blesses those who are poor and realize their need for Him, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. God blesses those who mourn, for they'll be comforted. God blesses those who are humble, for they are going to inherit the whole earth. God blesses those who are hungry and thirsty for justice, for they're going to be satisfied. God blesses those who are merciful, for they'll be shown mercy. God blesses those whose hearts are pure, for they will see God. God blesses those who work for peace, for they will be called children of God. God blesses those who are persecuted. God blesses you when people mock you and persecute you and lie about you and say all sorts of evil things against you because you're my followers. Be happy about it. Be blessed. Be very glad, for a great reward awaits you in heaven. God blesses. God blesses. God bless. I drive bus 245, and anybody at any time on bus 245 that does, there will be somebody on my bus that says, bless you. And the God guy in me that knows that I can't talk about religious things on the bus to my students, I take great delight that they're speaking blessings over each other. Jesus says over and over, God blesses, God blesses, God blesses. There's 9 or 10 times that he says, there's a blessing that God has for people in these circumstances. Depending on the translation you have, it might say happy. Isn't that a lovely thought? Doesn't it sound wonderful that one of Jesus' key tenets to his ministry, his life, and his presence is your happiness? Isn't that a big deal? Don't you take some joy, as crazy and as awful as your life really is right now? I just need you to know that Jesus wants to be a part of that presence so that you can be blessed, so that you can find some joy, so that you can be happy. You know what I said about my dad? That he sort of taught us and trained us to take delight in whatever the circumstances. I didn't know I was poor as a kid until I was past it. The kind of joy that Jesus is suggesting for us, that he's offering, that he introduces, it's a joy that is beyond circumstances. It's one that says there's something more, and it doesn't have to do with how things are around you. God blesses people. And so I want to unpack those things just a little bit, those blessing things. Here's the idea. We're sitting at the feet of Jesus. We're either skeptics that are going, oh, now what? Or we're devotees that are leaning forward and saying, now what? I'm submitting to you that Jesus is saying, now what? I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what. You're going to be blessed. And he starts breaking it down. Blessed are you if you're poor. If you're poor in spirit. If you're living life in such a broken way that you know that you need him. He starts off right away with the very first of many paradoxes. And he's saying, you want to be blessed? It's really about knowing who I am and finding your identity in me. It really is about us seeing us for who we are and Him for who He is. To be poor in spirit, that's one of the phrases that's used. To be poor in spirit is to be empty of myself. This kind of spiritual poverty doesn't lead to brokenness. It leads to a joy that's deep. People are still, long after her death, confused by Mother Teresa because she lived and chose extreme poverty, but there was an inner joy that, apart from this kind of presence of Jesus, cannot be explained. I want that for me. I want to be poor in spirit. Jesus says, my kingdom is populated with those kind of poor people. The kind of people that are so poor that they know they need me. It's what makes it possible for us to live not selfishly, but selflessly. He said, now what? You want to know? You know what I have in mind for you? You're going to be blessed, and you're going to be blessed even if you're sad. Even if you're a person that mourns. Could I just say that grief is the emotion of loss? And who among us hasn't known loss? Everybody's got a story, and everybody has heartbreaking things that they're aware of or not even aware of. But I'm just saying, the world's a broken place. And the one who knows me best says, you're going to be blessed, even if your sorrow is complete, because I'm your only comfort. You're going to be blessed if you're mournful, because I'm going to be the one that brings you comfort. My family and I have gone through some dark, dark days. As my son, when he was 30 years old, died of cancer. It was awful, and it's heartbreaking, and it's still even impossible to believe. But in that deep darkness, that's where many of us found the presence of God to be most beautiful and most present. Blessed are those who mourn. You're going to be blessed if you're humble, if you're meek. Not cowardly. Not something that says, oh, I'm just so meek and so humble that I... No, this is more like a lion that's been tamed. A lion that has all of this power, but keeps it under control. Meekness is a byproduct of humbling one's heart to God, to realize, I have this in me, and it's because it's a gift from Him that I'm a man that does surrendering well. We're the people that live with our palms up and open, without shame. It's a humility that is real and genuine. There's a reality that says, I live in a humility that means I'm hurt if God is offended. A humility that says, I'm here to bring peace to a situation. Humility that says, I listen to Scripture, and when I discover things in His Word that are in conflict with how I'm doing life, I choose to rework my life and change my habits and to make other choices. Humility says, I can receive criticism. Humility says, because of my brokenness before Him, it makes me stronger. And do you hear what He promises there? Those people will inherit the earth. You know what that means? I have no idea. I mean, it's too big for me to grasp. I don't know. All I know is there's beauty and there's value and there's worth in being a man who is truly humble. The kind of blessedness that He's offering, when we ask the question, now what? He says, you're going to be blessed, and you're going to be blessed if you're hungry. If you're hungry for the right things, do you Do you fight for justice? What does that look like in your life? It's not an option. Sometimes I work out of my passions, and it has more to do with my anger, has more to do with my rage. It doesn't have to do often enough with people that are looked down on, that are struggling. But what he describes here is an intense drive. It's not enough to just be passionate. It's more important that that hunger takes us to a deeper place. Jesus tells this story about a son who was hungry for life, and he approaches his dad and he says, "Dad, give me my inheritance now." And his dad, who was wise, was reluctant, but gave him his inheritance. And the son left home and spent it all on wild living. And he was hungry. He had run out of all the resources. He was finally hungry enough that the only job he could get, now remember Jesus, the Jewish rabbi, is telling the story, the only job he could get was as a swineherd. He was a pig herder. There isn't anything more detestable in the minds of a Jewish person than a pig. And this poor kid left his home, his father, spent the money, and was in this faraway country feeding pigs. He was so hungry that he thought about stealing some of the pig food to snack on that. And just before he was snacking with the pigs, that's when he decides, wait, even the servants that work for my dad have a better life than this. The kind of hunger that Jesus is talking about is not about living with the pigs, but it's running back home. He had rehearsed a speech. "Father, I've sinned, and I don't deserve this, but if you would just allow me the privilege of being your servant." And his father wrapped him up in a hug, and he tried the speech a second time, and it was muffled by the hug. The father was waiting for that. The hunger that Jesus was talking about is hungry for the hug. He was starving, but it was satisfied when he found his father. You're going to be blessed if you're merciful. You won't be treated with mercy from others. It's not finding it from other people. It's finding it from God. And he's there to meet the needs of you. And so, merciful people that receive it from God, they pass it on to other people. Do you know that person I'm talking about who's always quick to love and to help other people? That's the one. Jesus said, you're going to be blessed if you're pure of heart. If you're a pure heart. If you're holy and good. It's not about your heart. It's not about the organ. It's not about the center of your emotions. It's not the Valentine thing. This is what Jesus is talking about, is the core of your thinking process. If down to your very cell, you're seeking things that are good and right, purity is not flawlessness, but rather, it's being cleansed. It's asking Jesus to do his job. David in Psalm 86 says, "Teach me your ways, O Lord, that I can live according to your truth. Grant me an undivided heart, O God, so that I can honor you." An undivided heart. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about pure of heart. Jesus says you're going to be blessed if you're a peacemaker. We're the ones that bring peace. We work for peace. There's this reality that we live in a broken, sin-filled world. And we're the ones who are led by the Prince of Peace. And the last one, ironically, is, and blessed are you when you're harassed, when you're persecuted, when you're mocked, when you're lied about, when you're lied to. I need to tell you that peacemakers aren't loved. They're not always loved. That being a peacemaker is a dangerous role. But Jesus says, you can do this. Wait a second, Jesus. what's so happy about being poor or mourning or being humbled or being persecuted? Look, all I asked was, now what? And you're giving me all this stuff that, well, honestly, it freaks me out a little bit. Got no tidy answers, not right now. I'm just saying we're about to jump into this thing where Jesus is spilling out lots of paradoxes, where he's undoing a tidy, orderly world. And in the midst of the chaos, he's going to say, you want some true happiness? That's what I'm talking about here. So if you're a skeptic, I need to ask, how's that working out for you? I mean, are you genuinely satisfied? And frankly, as a devotee, if that's how you labeled yourself, did I just describe your life? Or were some of Jesus' words a little bit hard to swallow? Were some of his options difficult to invest in fully? Oh, no, no. I want these things on the list, but not that. I would like to be blessed, but here's how I'd prefer to be blessed. And we're looking at the King of the Kingdom and saying, yeah, thanks for all that you've said, but this is what I prefer. How's that working out for you? In this now what thing, I just want to remind you that we have choices. And I want to challenge you to join the paradox. As a matter of fact, next Sunday night, we're going to be meeting at the Vancouver Tech Center in Vancouver, Washington, on Southeast 34th at Hiddenbrook. We're going to be meeting in the lunchroom area, and you're invited. Be there at 5 o'clock. Bring your mask. Bring some gloves if you want to. You have to stay 6 feet away from everybody, but those that are in your family. We're going to continue this conversation. We'll also continue in an online presence. If you're nervous about getting together, don't. If you have a fever or don't feel well, don't. It really is okay. We'll continue this. You just won't get to see me this close up. I love you, though. I'm so glad that we're part of this together. Let's do this some more, because the question is, now what?